a great privilege to be here and talk about a text I love and a text that has, I think, had enormous ramifications throughout Western history. We frequently think of, when we think of the city of God, if we think of it at all, we tend to focus on one slice. Usually Book 19 is the one that gets taught in political theory programs. We get a very thin slice of Augustine's City of God, which is tends to be read within a modern context, so that the City of God has something to tell us about the relationship between church and state, is usually how we think about the City of God. Anybody who's read the whole of the City of God knows that that is really just a very small slice of the City of God, and that it's a systematic work that medievals poured over. And indeed, Thomas Aquinas poured over the City of God. He poured over, for example, his most significant investigations in the City of God were on Augustine's treatment of emotions or passions, and developed the most significant account of the passions in the 13th century on the basis of Book 14 of the City of God. So it provided an important text for the 13th century with a very different lens than we see the City of God today. For us, it has a very particular context within the modern liberal order. For the 13th century, it had a wide array of uses. They looked to it for how the bishop was understood, what counted as a good bishop. They looked to it for how do you engage the Platonists. They look to the City of God to how you make arguments towards the final good and the supreme good. They look to the City of God for their account of Christ's sacrifice. They look to the City of God for a narrative about bodily resurrection and what does it mean to come to know and love the triune God in the beatific vision. So they looked to the City of God with a wide range of systematic interests. And I want to just talk about one interest that the medievals had. The medievals were very interested in one particular line about the virtue of religion in the City of God. And so I want to pull that line out for you in your handout. And I don't want to impose Thomas onto the text so much as interpose. Put Thomas alongside of the text that we're going to walk through, these texts that we're going to walk through, and look at how the virtue of religion is developed. In order to do that, I want to give you a little bit of a primer on Aquinas, on the virtue of religion, and how he reads it. Of course, he has access to the City of God at Paris, and he cites it regularly. He cites the City of God throughout the Summa. He has a thoroughgoing knowledge of pretty much every book is reflected in the 22 books. How many of you have read some or part of the City of God? Just give me an idea. Okay. You know it has these, it's kind of divided into two parts. Books 1 through 10 are an argument with the Roman gods, and the argument is, the accusation is that Christianity is to blame for the fall of Rome, and so Augustine mounts an argument to say that Christianity is not to blame, that Rome's morals, Rome's politics, and Rome's religion is actually what presents a kind of instability within Rome's own life, and so he makes an argument about how the gods really have never done any temporal good for the Roman people in books 1 through 5, and then in books 6 through 10, how they do no eternal good because they attach them to the wrong. Their Platonist philosophers can get them ordered to the supreme good, but they can't get them attached to the supreme good with the right kind of devotion, with the right religio. And so right from the first half of the book, you see that the theme of religio is extremely important. In the second half, books 11 through 22, he talks about the origins, histories, and destinies of two cities, an earthly city which turns away from God, and a heavenly city which is perfectly ordered to God. And this is not the empirical city versus the church. This is not St. Paul's versus the city of Cambridge. This is two cities who, in a sense, represent two dispositions towards God and man, towards good and evil. And through that argument, in books 11 through 22, we also see the theme of the question of religio, of religion. And that comes out in its tie to the virtue of justice. Thomas teaches that religio, religion, is a special virtue tied or ordered to the cardinal virtue of justice. It's a special virtue which attends to justice. It's a virtue which perfects the habits in the affections and the will. And so religion is tied to justice and to the right ordering. And so in the second half of The City of God, Augustine's interested to make the argument against Cicero's definition of a republica, of a commonwealth, as demanding to each his due. The classical definition of a kind of perfect justice is required for there to be a commonwealth, for there to be a people, for there to be a common good. And Augustine wants to say, Rome was never a commonwealth on this basis because it's always lacked true justice. Why does it lack true justice? Because it lacks true religio, because you need the proper religio in order to unite you perfectly. And Augustine thinks you have to be united perfectly to justice in order to meet the strict Ciceronian definition of a res publica. So even in the second half, which is which gets us to our famed passage in 19, it's still the virtue of religio that's critical. All right, with that prologue aside, to talk a little bit about how Thomas arranges these. Augustine and Aquinas are often assumed to disagree with each other on the nature of virtue. Augustine defines virtue sometimes as the right ordering of our loves. Other times he defines it in the way that Thomas likes it to be defined. In fact, Thomas borrows Augustine's other definition of virtue, which is a quality of mind by which we live rightly or righteously, which can't be misused and which God works in us without us. Now, that last phrase, that God would work in us without us, is the troubling phrase between Augustine and Aquinas, because it's presumed that Aquinas thinks there can be a perfectible natural virtue which is acquired and attained by our own powers without assistance from beyond. Augustine here is saying that virtue has to be that in which God works in us without us. So there must be, in a sense, some infusion of divine assistance in order for us to be virtuous. Aquinas doesn't actually think they have an argument. Aquinas wants to say, no, this is when Augustine says this, he is actually just referring to the infused virtues of faith, hope, and love that come and assist and elevate and perfect the natural acquired virtues in us. And then in other places, Thomas will say, and this is also something like Aristotle's idea of something akin to an infused virtue, that we need some assistance from outside luck to be virtuous. And so Thomas has at least two ways of trying to say, look, actually think Aristotle and Augustine fit together. Now, that's a big deal in the 13th century, because in the 13th century, all the theologians want to say you can't fit Aristotle and Augustine together. They're at loggerheads. Thomas's whole project is to say they do fit together. That Aquinas doesn't want to seek a departure from Augustine, but he wants to see that he fits with a certain set of Aristotelian distinctions. And this is also true on the virtue of religion. And so that's a sort of background. Second background point, and then we'll turn to our text here, is that for both Thomas and
Augustine, virtue is this habit, a habitual definition of virtue which inclines to the good. Vice is a habit which is not consonant with our nature and inclines to evil. If you observe a habit, if you observe a habit that is called a virtue, but doesn't incline to the good, you have a problem. You have a misrecognition of a virtue. And that's what Augustine is going to do in the first book. He's going to try to distinguish in several Roman exemplars, but we'll look at two. Try to distinguish for his Roman readers ways in which they misidentify a virtue in an agent and ways in which they rightly identify a virtue in an agent. And both of these agents are not Christians. And so we want to talk a little bit about this. And then we'll talk about, this is looking at natural virtue here in this first section. And then we'll talk about supernatural virtue of religio. And then we'll get back to that famous book 19 that you all know. Book 1, 10, and 22 are sort of the beginning, middle, and end. And so we're doing the beginning, middle, and almost the end today. But book 1 really sets up an argument not so much with the Platonists yet. That will come. But in book 1, he's setting up an argument for how to face suffering. Rome has suffered a major attack. The city suffered some physical damage, 3-day attack, but really a psychological damage, including numbers of raped women, and the sense that Rome was not eternal anymore was also a kind of political damage. And so he opens his arguments with the Romans with a question about how does Rome suffer? How do you suffer, and how do you deal with suffering? And he looks at mainly Stoic figures who each one of them, Lucretia, Regulus, and Cato, each have various modes of self-sacrifice in response to suffering. Lucretia, most famously, suicide, and Cato, suicide. Suicide as a response to suffering. He writes here in the first quote there, "When the good and wicked suffer alike, the identity of their sufferings doesn't mean that there's no difference between them. What matters is the nature of the sufferer, not the nature of the sufferings." So he wants to lead his argument with the moral question, with the virtuous question. Is what does it mean to be ordered to the good, to be virtuous in a way that inclines to the good
habitually?
And so here part of his definition. Virtue is the condition of right living, holds command over the parts of body from the throne of the mind, and then he adds the other aspects, which I've already read from Thomas. Now, the two examples that I want to talk about here, Lucretia is often the one who's looked at for Augustine's view on virtue here, because when you look at Lucretia, Lucretia is a figure who... you know about Lucretia? Lucretia is important in Roman history. She, the princes are off in the monarchy, the monarchical period. They're off at the battle at Ardea, and they all decide to go into town, into Rome, and they to see their wives. And Prince Tarquin, the proud, falls in love with one of the other princesses' wives, and then he subsequently rapes her. And Lucretia, of course, calls for her husband and her father to come, and they come, and she demands that they seek her revenge for her honor, because she's been dishonored. Another man's seed is in your bed, Colotinus. And she said, if you are men, you will avenge this
dishonor. And then she plunges a knife into her chest and kills herself. This is a very important event, as you know, in the history of Rome, because this is what instigates the revolution, the Republican Revolution. Lucretius' body is carried out, and there's an uprising, and they drive the kings out of Rome, and they found the Republic. So Lucretius' suicide, Augustine, of course, wants to put his finger on it because this is the founding of the Republic. This is an important political event in Rome's history. How does that event begin? Well, with this moral exemplar that they admire. They admire Lucretia. She stands as the virtuous matron of Rome. She's the virtuous matron of Rome, and Augustine wants to say, well, how virtuous was she if in defense of her honor she destroys herself? What sort of virtue is that? So Lucretia's often looked to, because the looking to Lucretia will allow someone to say, you see, Augustine doesn't think anybody's virtuous apart from faith, right? Lucretia's not virtuous. So we see here the example of Lucretia. The highly extolled Lucretia also did away with the innocent, chaste, outraged Lucretia. Give your sentence. And Augustine actually gives the most developed argument to date for against suicide in the classical world. It's a little bit in Plato. You can find smatterings here against suicide, but largely suicide was an acceptable response to suffering. And Augustine's saying, no, it's not. Suicide is not a respectable response to suffering. It actually increases the injustice. So Lucretius had this great injustice done to her, and she increases the injustice. The adulterer, or the rapist, rather, gets off scot-free, or rather is just banished from town, and Lucretia gets the death penalty. Where's the justice in that? And so Lucretia becomes an important exemplar. For Rome, she represents for Rome honor and glory. To Augustine, she is a representation of disordered virtue, of being excessively eager for honor. That's what she's after. That's the end to which her act is ordered, is to preserve her honor. She is not after the common good of Rome. She's after preserving her honor. She's not after the highest good, which would be due to God, say, and that would be the virtue of religion. So she's neither. Her sacrificial act in response to suffering is not virtuous. Indeed, it has beneath it the problem of self-love and a disordering of the soul, so that it can't reach its good, can't even reach the basic good of its own existence. Such has not been the behavior of Christian women. And so he contrasts this. Lucretia is raped and commits suicide. What sort of virtue is that? Christian women were raped but trusted divine providence and trusted that they were not defiled by that rape, but that God keeps their honor intact and as they trust in him. So Lucretia is a common example. The example that's less looked at, though probably the best treatment of Regulus in the world today, is written by a political theorist named Pierre Menon. If you ever are a political theorist, if there's any political theorists in this room, Pierre Menon's Metamorphoses of the City has, I think, the best treatment of Regulus in literature today. But Regulus is interesting because Regulus also has a famed presence in Roman history. He's the great general who defeats the Carthaginians in the First Punic War. But then, unfortunately, he's captured. And the Carthaginians they make a deal so that if Regulus is captured, but if Regulus goes back and makes a pitch for a peace treaty that would involve an exchange of prisoners, Regulus can take his freedom. If he fails to secure, he has to go back to the Carthaginians, and everyone knows what the Carthaginians are going to do to him when he gets back. And how do they secure this? Well, they secure it by asking him to make an oath to the gods. And so Regulus does. He makes an oath to the gods that he'll come back if he doesn't secure it, that he'll fight his honor. Augustine records this. He says he proceeded to Rome. In the Senate, he successfully urged the rejection of the proposal, since he didn't think it was to the advantage of Rome. It wasn't for the common good of Rome. Augustine regards this as virtuous. Right? Our enemies, since he had taken the oath to the gods, he voluntarily fulfilled his obligation. These are important kind of conditions that Augustine recognizes for natural virtue. The oath to the gods is the virtue of religion, right? Under a natural aspect for Thomas. That he voluntarily fulfills his obligation. This is the nature of a habit ordered inclining to the good. And, of course, ordered to the virtue of justice and ordered to the virtue of fortitude, courage. Our enemies are certainly right to praise a courage. Augustine's saying here the enemies are those Romans who accuse Christianity of weakening Rome. Our enemies are certainly right to praise a courage which rose superior to so dreadful a fate. And yet he is sworn by those gods, the prohibition of whose worship has led, in their opinion, to the infliction of these recent disasters on the human race. The Romans who are critical of Christianity, Christianity's critics, are saying that it's actually, they're like Julian the Apostate from the 370s who wanted to return the empire to the ancestral gods. The critics of Christianity want to say, Rome fell because we left the gods behind. Theodosius in 380 makes the empire Christian. He destroys temples. He pulls out the funds for polytheistic devotion. And there's a backlash against that. And it doesn't help that Rome got sacked. So our enemies are right to praise the courage. But those gods didn't help Regulus. Those gods did no good for Regulus. He says, I can conclude by my reasoning two lines of argument. Regulus venerated the gods, and the result was that because of his oath, he did not stay in his own country, but went without the least hesitation to his fiercest enemies. It was not because he clung to life that he refused suicide. He proved this when, because of his oath, he returned. He set little store. And by this we can gather that he considered suicide a serious crime. Among all the heroes, men worthy of honor and renown for virtue, the Romans have none greater to produce. This is high praise. Augustine is praising a pagan, idolater, for his virtue. This does not fit the typical image of Augustine. Among all the heroes, the Romans have none greater to produce. Such heroes of Rome fought, and here's two key distinctions, for their earthly country, for the common good, and he also says, the gods they worshipped were false, but their worship was genuine, and they faithfully kept their oaths. Now, this is a theme that will interest a Thomist, because the Thomist will be interested in the fact that the interior act of worship, every virtue can have it has an internal and an external act for Thomas. And so the Thomist will read this and say, the interior act, there was a certain genuineness to the Regulus's duty to worship was being properly observed interiorly in his intention. He intends to render what is due to the gods. His intellect doesn't tell him that there's just one god. His intellect tells him that there's many gods and that he has a devotion to one of them, and he makes an oath to that one. And then interiorly, Augustine says that worship was genuine, even though the object was false. The exterior act of religion was false, but the interior act was genuine. Now, this is remarkable, because this tells us something very interesting about what Augustine thinks about virtue and religion, that they have to be tied together. And they have to be tied together, but they're not conditionally tied together on Christian faith. That there is a kind of imperfect pagan virtue, even the virtue of religio, that's respected here. Even though the external act of religio was false. And there you have imperfection. Right? So Augustine does think that this isn't a perfect virtue, but it's still a virtue. It's recognizably virtuous. We must show how the true God and whose power are all kingdoms deign to assist them in attaining the moral qualities needed for the increase of their empire, although those reputed gods of theirs gave them no assistance. So now he's flipping it so that now we have to show the reason why Rome really did well was not because they put their faith in these false gods. They did well because they had a sense of the common good, and because they had the right disposition of worship to God, they had the wrong object. And so what they really need to see, what needs to come into their intellect, because the will is blind, needs to have, for Thomas, the will is a kind of blind power, and it needs the intellect to present things to the will. And so the intellect needs to be persuaded that there's one God, one true God, and that that God is the one who's brought all the blessings to Rome. That's the God who has brought all the blessings to Rome. And then the interior act of natural religio could be fitted to a proper exterior act and establish the right kind of devotion. And that's what Augustine's wanting to aim at, is the right kind of devotion. Questions before I turn to the next section? Any questions? I'm in teacherly mode now. It's the end of the semester.
How would Augustine have looked on like the suicide of Dido, for example, with Aeneas?
He mentions it in passing. He thinks all suicide is wrong. I can't remember exactly what he doesn't have a direct comment about it. But I imagine he would want to say something very similar. Do you have thoughts on
that? He looks at Aeneas as a hero, right?
Aeneas is a hero and is virtuous.
Yeah.
The thing that gets neglected about Augustine, because he becomes a kind of cipher for Jansen, it becomes a cipher for Calvin, that Augustine becomes a cipher for certain 16th century Catholic and Protestant tendencies, that you cease to look at Augustine as Augustine. You cease to read him as Augustine. People don't sit down and read Augustine the way the 13th century thinkers did. They read him through a 16th century lens, and then they just simply pass over Aeneas. They simply pass over Regulus. Much of the literature that you read on Book 1 of the City of God just talks about Lucretia. Because Lucretia confirms the thesis, right?
Moving on to the virtue of religion in your second section here. This is page 3.
In Book 8, he talks about, on your second quote there, the line we followed in the 8th book was to select the philosophers with whom we should debate the question of life following death. Book 8, I wanted to talk about, but we don't have time, but Book 8 is a magnificent argument for one God via reading the history of the schools at Athens. So he goes through the pre-Socratics and how the pre-Socratics are all materialists and they're looking for some intelligent spark, some beginning, some sense of a cause or final end. And then he turns to Socrates, Socrates' final end being a kind of pivotal point. And then, of course, Plato, the Peripatetics, and then, of course, the middle, second academy, and then this new academy, the skeptics, the third academy. Skeptics are treated in interesting ways. But the review of the history of philosophy is all to say The history of philosophy working well is a history of moving towards the one true God. So Book 8 is this magnificent argument for monotheism based on both Greco and Roman history of philosophy. So here he says, this is what we followed in the 8th book, and now we're talking about these philosophers who got to recognize that we do owe a duty, we have a duty to worship the one true God. We can know that the intellect can know that there's a God, and we can know that the wise man will be made wise by contemplating the one God, who's the end of all happiness. We selected the Platonists because they've been best able to recognize this, that the soul of man cannot attain happiness except by the participation of the light of God. So here you get a kind of eudaimonian account at its end, at its terminus. The desire for happiness, all men desire to be happy, is a truism, he says, right? That all men desire happiness is a truism for all. But what is the end of happiness? What's the terminus of that? And it's the highest good, the one true God. And that the Platonists recognized that we could only be, our happiness could only be perfected by participation in that. And that the Platonists are also recognized as good interlocutors for the church because they understand unless the philosopher is adhered, ad herare, is united, is clings to, unless there's a mode of attachment, a right kind of devotion which would unite you, a religio, with the purity of chaste love, you're not going to be happy. You need the right kind of attachment. Now, the later Platonic tradition really develops the idea of daimons connecting you to the gods, and the gods connecting you to the one God. And they have a very strong hierarchy. And of course, Augustine wants to blow that apart so that you arrive at a place in which you see that there's only one mode of mediation that will really get you ad herare to the supreme good, and that's Christ. For our good, that final good, is nothing else but to cleave to him whose spiritual embrace fills the intellectual soul and makes it fertile with true virtues. No one would dare to assert that sacrifice is due to any other being than God. The true sacrifice is offered in every act which is designed to unite us to God in a holy fellowship. Every act, that is, which is directed to that final good, making possible our felicity. So now we see in the discussion that religio has an external object too, namely sacrifice. And sacrifice has also an interior and exterior aspect. Does God need sacrifice? No, God doesn't need sacrifice. But we need sacrifice. We need an interior sacrifice of devotion. Because why? Because justice requires that we render God his due worship. We render God his due worship, and that requires a sacrifice of devotion, of worship. Sorry, I'm not checking my phone. I actually have notes on my phone, so this is really bad when the professor's checking his phone. That's a really boring lecture if they're checking their phone. If the professor's checking his phone, it's really bad. So the virtue of religion is that which perfects our power to render to God worship, the worship that he is due as the first principle of all things. And Augustine's shown that you can know this by reason. You can know by reason that there is one God, and you can know by reason that you owe that God worship due to him, just as you owe your neighbor things which are due to your neighbor. Now, this is precisely what we saw in Regulus and Lucretia.
or rather, it's what we saw in Regulus, but not in Lucretia. Lucretia's so-called virtue was not a habit inclining to the good. Neither was it inclining to a common good, nor was it inclining to the highest good, the pinnacle of which would be God. Indeed, Lucretia's account of virtue inclines to the contrary of her good, self-destruction. Regulus is admired by Augustine precisely because his habit inclines A, to the common good of Rome, and B, to the highest good as he understands it, namely what he calls genuine worship. And this tells us the object of religion. The object of religion may be surprisingly so, but for Thomas, the object of religion is not God. Anyone have enough Thomistic distinctions to know what the object would be? The object of the virtue of religion is worship itself. That worship is the object, that the genuine worship that Augustine recognizes, that is something which is a quality, a disposition, and a kind of devotion which produces acts. And the acts will be sacrificial. And so the kind of interior disposition which is required is a kind of disposition which God causes, right? That God has to be the cause of both the interior disposition and the exterior aspect of the sacrifice. God has to be the first mover in the soul and has to be the first mover of the sacrifice which unites. And so both Thomas and Augustine want to say that for religio to properly attach us, we need sacrificial acts, interior and exterior, which God alone is the mover of. God is the cause of. And we can participate in. We can participate in, and of course Augustine loves that word for Platonic reasons, but that we can participate in true religio and offer the right kind of devotion through Christ. It's Christ who is this sacrifice, this external sacrifice, which conforms us in the act of faith, which is an interior sacrifice in which we recognize and receive the light of faith. And by that act of faith, we can render true worship to God. And this actually perfects and elevates our natural virtue of religion that Regulus has. Regulus can be, by the act of faith, elevated. He doesn't have to, he's being perfected in the natural virtue of religio in the act of faith. And so the act of faith is actually elevating and purifying the natural virtue of religio as Thomas would see it. My true good is to cling to God through the great priest who offered himself and his suffering for us so that we might be the body of so great a head. Under the form of a servant, that is his humanity, because under this form he is mediator, in this form he is priest, in this form he is sacrificed. And this is the sacrifice of Christians, of which the church continually offers on the sacrament of the altar. My Protestant friends are always surprised by these last two quotes, 10:6 and 10:20, because Augustine repeatedly refers to the Eucharist as a daily sacrifice. Protestants tend not to like the word sacrifice for the sacraments. But here it's a sacrament of the altar, a sacrifice of the altar, which is adherare, is attaching us in an external form to God himself. This is the reality, the daily sacrifice, the true sacrifice, and all false sacrifices yield to it. So the virtue of natural religio can be perfected by being united to the true sacrifice. You see this also in just the way you watch Mass, and you can see that Augustine says when you watch gifts being presented, you're actually seeing
the natural virtue of really being brought forward and then consecrated and elevated and carried up, perfected, so that it actually unites us to God.
All right. Now, the big leap, once we recognize that there is a kind of compatibility, or at least Aquinas thinks there's a compatibility between himself and Augustine on natural virtue and true sacrifice, then we can look at the modern issue of how to interpret Book 19, this book which tells us how we order society in relationship to the church. The dominant interpretive line comes from Robert Marcus, a great scholar, who popularized, initiated an idea about Book 19 as an image of the church over here, and then a kind of neutral secular order over here. And
this, of course, unsurprisingly, completely unhinges any connection between Augustine's treatment of how you have an association of people ordered together in relationship to justice, or how that virtue of justice would be ordered to the highest good and united to the virtue of religion. And so let's walk through and see how we might imagine how this treatment so far gets us out of an idea about the church over here and a neutral secular order over here. The heavenly city knows only one God as the object of worship and decrees with faithful devotion that he only is to be served with that service that the Greeks call latria. This is a kind of recapitulation of Book 10 on the virtue of religion. He says, even the heavenly city in her pilgrimage here on earth makes use of the earthly peace and defends and seeks the compromise between human wills in respect of the provisions relevant to the moral nature of man, so far as may be permitted without detriment to true religion and piety. Augustine's imagining here the way in which the earthly city and the heavenly city actually can live in a kind of harmony that isn't segregated, but has indeed the ways in which he talks about the heavenly city can defend and seek compromise between human wills, is a way in which the church is somehow involved, actually, in lesser temporal affairs. The church can be involved in lesser temporal affairs, so far as may be permitted without detriment to true religion and piety. But then when we get to 21 and then 23 and 24, we see, A, in 1921, you see the culmination of his argument about with Cicero, that Cicero's definition of a republic, that it requires rendering what is due to each, and if Cicero's definition is strict, then Rome was never a republic because it doesn't render what's due to God. On a strict definition, he wants to take away the Ciceronian definition. And guess who gets the Ciceronian definition then? The church. So the city of God on pilgrimage gets the strict definition. Why? Because of the virtue of religion. Because it renders true justice to God. It renders the sacrifice which unites us perfectly and renders what is due to God and neighbor. And so he, in a sense, reserves Cicero's high, high ideal for a republic, perfect justice to each is due. He reserves that for the societas perfecta, the perfect society, not the church in all of its sinfulness, but the Holy Church in its culminating sacrament of the altar with the host raised high. That's, in a sense, perfect justice. That's true religion. And that is the true res publica. Then he admits a lesser definition. He says, well, you could have another definition for res publica, and then Rome gets to be a commonwealth.
If, on the other hand, another definition of is found, if one should say, a people is the association of a multitude of rational beings united by a common agreement on the objects of their love, then it follows there is no absurdity in applying it to the title of a people. The better the objects of this agreement, the better the people. The worse the objects of this love, the worse the people. By this definition of ours, the Roman people is a people, and its estate is indubitably a commonwealth. Here, what I think he's doing is not setting the church over here as perfect society, and over here, a notion of association as a multitude of rational beings united by common objects. But he's actually hanging one on top of the other. So that actually what you have, surprise, surprise, is a hierarchy. You have a hierarchy in which the Ciceronian ideal for res publica is now reserved for something which actually ties you to the ideal, ties you to the heaven. And that the second definition, which is actually also implicitly referencing Aristotle's definition, implicitly referencing another aspect of Cicero's definition of common agreement and friendship, that second definition actually can hang in such a way that it touches and at the pinnacle of a scalar account of common objects of love, because you could have a scaled account, a hierarchical account in which really, you can imagine so many different kinds of republics ordered around so many different kinds of common goods and common loves that go all the way up the scale, all the way up to reach what? The natural virtue of religion. Until they reach the point in which they can recognize the one true God, until they can be at the top of that scale, and at that point, that church is there to proclaim the gospel and raise up any given commonwealth. And so, Augustine, if we get out of the Marcus approach, which is really just a Rawlsian approach to Augustine, and get into a 13th century Thomistic hierarchical account of these two definitions of res publica, we actually get a much better and more interesting view of the church as a kind of hydraulic entity in every culture, every city, every society, in which the church actually has this sacred duty to neighbor now, which is a duty which is bound up with their duty to God and their duty to neighbor, to be the elevating presence, to pull people up that scalar account in which you could have commonwealths that were so far away from any notion of a common good or from the highest good. The church would still have to work to pull up that res publica on that second definition. And by looking at the virtue of religion question, you actually start to put together a more medieval account, a more Thomistic account of Augustine's City of God, which makes better sense of the whole than modern liberal approaches to Augustine's City in Western civilization. Thank you. Take questions, yeah.
Thank you very much. I was surprised that we were able to get through some of the ideas but one thing that came to mind, particularly because I had an interesting conversation with a utilitarian about a week ago, because when we talk about when we talk about all men desire happiness, I think that's something that most people would agree on, or they're just disconnected from their own humanity. But then to say that happiness is not an end in itself, what would be some touchstones that we could use to walk someone through understanding happiness is not an end in itself? It could be wrong without harms.
Well, your last point is the Mildean one, right? That there could be
wrongs without harms? Is that what you wanted?
Yeah, I guess I'm just still preempted from what my conversation was, but it seems to revolve around this idea that, I mean, the ultimate good is there being less pain, more pleasure. Is the fallacy there reducing happiness to pleasure, or but here there's still that they're still attached to this idea of, and they are, I mean, most people I think that live a very secular removed life from God is like, well, whatever makes me happy,
right,
and that's the end that I pursue with everything else, with all my other means. So how do we show someone actually, even if you're growing more towards the ends that make you happy, you can still be doing wrongs?
It's interesting because Augustine takes an idea along these lines about justice. Justice is just whatever I can secure with my power. And there's a kind of version of that here with the Millian account that happiness is just whatever I can secure. Augustine thinks that's barbaric. It's just chaos. There's no ordering of anything to any end. And so I think the basic problem is not just utilitarianism, but the attack on the teleological view that you're not ordering anything. Any act is never ordered to anything which you could call a higher good. It's always to some imminent good that I'm choosing, and so it's constantly located in the will. It's never about the intellect presenting a good for the will to choose from. I think it's a very Augustinian answer. It's a kind of enslavement to the will, which is sort of bound just to chase your tail.
Where's the common good in that question?
Where's the common good? I mean, I think that might be a nice way in, actually, especially in our political climate, in which people actually recognize there's a certain purchase on that claim that America doesn't have a common good, or has difficulty naming what the common goods that everybody shares in. I think most people recognize that as a problem. They don't know why it's a problem, but I think maybe I'm wrong about that, maybe that's naive, but I think people do think that America has a common good problem. Strong political polarization. Yes?
So on that phrase, without us?
Yes, yes, back to the beginning.
I don't know.
Whether or not Aquinas is fudging or not.
Well, I know, does that we even believe that? I mean, don't we believe it's got to cooperate with us, grace? It's got to somehow meet us?
For natural virtue?
That's
the beef is whether or not that account of virtue. So the 13th century dispute is whether or not Augustine's account of virtue holds for all virtue or only for infused virtue, right? And Aquinas wants to say, no, it actually holds for all virtue. Augustine's account is solid, except for we just have to reserve that God works in us without us for A, infused virtue under one aspect, and under another aspect, he has a distinction where it can count as something like Aristotelian luck. There's something working in us to get us to be virtuous that we're not responsible for, right? And kids at Harvard, they got a lot of lucky breaks in order to be at Harvard, right? That sort of, or maybe we're just a total meritocracy in this. Sorry, the Pelagian.
God doesn't want us to lose consent, right? It's that whole kind of, which came first, God's grace or our consent, or, you know,
Augustine also says God doesn't do anything without us. So this is Augustine, really, people associate the operative, cooperative grace distinction in Thomas with Thomas, but it's really in Augustine.
Yeah.
Augustine really provides us with a distinction between God's operative grace is when God moves alone. God's the sole mover. As he is with infused virtues. God's the soul. God, you didn't do anything. You didn't make the first move to come to Christian faith. God was the first mover. And then cooperative grace is where both God is mover and the human agent is mover. And that's straight Augustine.
Yeah.
Because Augustine wants to preserve the priority of divine action against a Pelagian insistence that human beings make the first move towards God, in which case you kind of save yourself.
Yeah.
Yes.
I was wondering if you thought there might be a tension between the claim that there's something good or admirable in the worship of false gods on the one hand, and the claim that sacrifices do exclusively to the actual God on the other, right? Which he defends. Because I take it that when he says no one would dare to assert the sacrifice is due to any other being than God, mm-hmm. he means, you know, actual God, not, you know, whatever you happen to be imagining or something.
Right.
So I guess it just sort of seems to me that, like, plausibly, if you think there's something admirable about worshiping false gods...
There's nothing admirable about worshiping false gods.
Oh, there is not. Okay. Well, then I...
Ask Elijah.
Yeah, there's nothing admirable about worshiping false gods. What I tried to show there was that what Augustine is particularly keen is saying that his worship was genuine, even though we worship false gods.
So when he says their worship was genuine, he's not actually saying something good about their worship.
I think he's saying something good about their intention. That the interior disposition of their act was actually ordered to the good, which was to render worship to God as much as they could understand. The intellect was presenting them with something false because the intellect was ignorant. Right? Regulus is ignorant of the one true God, and so the intellect is searching around for, you know, the will desires God but doesn't know how to find God. Without a lot of help, at least as Augustine sees it. The intellect needs a lot of help on its own by the light of natural intellect, and then ultimately, in order to be united to God, it needs supernatural help. So I think the point is a subtle one there, that the interior act, the intention of that, of the virtue of religion there, is something he admires and recognizes as genuine, even though it doesn't hit the target. It's the wrong target. Mm-hmm. So it's actually a pretty Thomistic distinction that the interior acts all right, the exterior acts false. That's an imperfect union. And so Regulus is not saved, even though he's admirable. Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, back.
So when you brought up happiness, it got me thinking about the paper I just wrote this weekend about worker dignity. Okay, it's a business part. So it's worker dignity. And I was looking at literature that talked about respect of the worker and that kind of thing. And as I read the management literature, there was sort of this standard that because somebody is human, you should respect them. Well, that's easy for me to get, but we see, of course, abuses all over the place. So not everybody agrees that just because somebody's human, you should respect them. And I started asking the question, by what standard do we set the human as this, so that they have their happiness and their fulfillment at work and so forth? And the only thing that I could go to was that... was to take it to the step of, as a Catholic, of course, I see man as being created in God's image, and that's why mm-hmm. we afford each other respect. But without that mm-hmm. foundation, I don't know where you go with it. I don't know why anybody should expect respect in the workplace if it's purely a secular perspective. You see what I mean? So I guess I'm wondering what either Augustine or Aquinas would.
I mean, obviously it's... superior, it's elevating, right? The moment that people recognize that there's a God and that we're created in God's image.
That's the hydraulic thing.
But let's say you're Augustine in the 5th century and you can't lead with supernatural truths, or you can't lead with those things. You have to lead with arguments that are familiar to people, right? Where, if Augustine was thrown into this context and said, how would you lead? I think he'd lead with ideas about how we're rational. And he'd lead with ideas like the idea that you could define a res publica as a multitude of rational agents. and that by virtue of being the kind of animal that reasons and builds cities and cooperates with each other, we're a different kind of animal than all the other animals. And that gives us a kind of integrity and a dignity that at least gets you a starting foot in the door and say, because I actually think people who are anti-religious, especially, do have a difficult time saying why human beings have greater dignity than turtles or whales. I think they do have a difficult time, but I do think there are non-theistic footholds. They're not great footholds, but I think there's non-theistic footholds for arguing that human beings have a different, higher dignity. We're made, I mean, even the early church fathers, without even turning to the scriptures, will say things like, just look at the human being pointed upright towards the heavens. Mm-hmm. Just look at our bodies, how we're made. We're made with a greater dignity that we can look up and wonder. I mean, that's
there's
not Imago Dei
there
yet.
There.
But that's closer. Then you get a sort of foothold and you don't have to say, well, only Catholics can give you the answer to human dignity. I think only Catholics can give you the perfect answer to human dignity.
I did kind of insinuate that in my paper.
No,
but
I think, in a sense,
because I was wrestling with it.
In a sense, you need the scalar view. See, having that scalar view, that hierarchical view, you can go up the scale of common objects of love, and you can keep going up it until it hits its terminus. And that's what I think Catholics need to be committed to in the public square is taking the common objects of love and trying to see how you can get them pointed, moving in the right direction. And I think human dignity is a really good example of that. Human dignity is a common good. We all share that. That is a real common good, and you know, it'd be good to have a conversation that didn't root human dignity in something fungible, something constantly changeable like the human will, which I just constantly construct the identity that I want. But that's just such a poor foundation for human dignity. But that's kind of what we have. Yes?
Actually, continuing with that question, from here we can derive just human dignity in general, fellow man, but if we recognize that the men are different, some people are stronger, some people are smarter.
Right.
Where do you derive equal human dignity among all those differing folk, I guess?
If it's just all rooted in the will, you mean, where's the...
No, just in general, just like, how does one, outside of a religious context, how does one derive, say, equality of human dignity among all men, despite differences in inferiority, superiority?
Yeah, no, I think the moment that you raise the equality question, it's actually a metaphysical theistic question. I mean, it's interesting because I do think the liberal tenets about equality are sneak in and smuggle in hidden theological claims. This is, I think, the moment that you ask about equality. Well, equality under what? Equality under law? We know that we think law, we're all positivists when it comes to law, right? We're constructing law. So what's the equality under? What's the standard by which we're equal? Is it the capacity to reason? Maybe that's a non-theistic answer, but maybe not.
So I want to ask you a question.
I want to give the theistic answer, but I think you need to start somewhere in certain debates.
I want to go to virtue and this idea of a free society and trying to point it as much as possible towards natural virtue, perhaps, or towards things that are, actually that's a question if you're taking it. So, I mean, first of all, is that the goal? Is that to try and create a society that, you know, if we sort of admit...
I think the goal is conversion.
Right, okay. But I guess in our secular world, well, we have to act, and we can't always be necessarily, like, overtly... That can't necessarily be the overt goal, you know, when we... writing Inuit papers or whatever, you know, nobody's necessarily going to read them if they're all just convert. But I'm wondering, I guess, how do we understand, yeah, what is the role then, and how do we sort of take the so when we had this very strong idea of what grace is doing in the role of virtue in the in our own lives,
mm-hmm.
Is it sort of mismatched to trying to go out into the world? Is it sort of inauthentic to go out and say, be virtuous, all the while knowing that, like, but you need God's grace to do that? And
I think the Thomist is interested in fitness between orders, right? You have a natural order in which things can work well in the orders of the good, and you have a supernatural order which is holiness and is elevating and uniting us to eternal happiness. But you want the concepts to be fit. And so I think there is a real labor to be done in making concepts fit to receive grace. And that is part of the hydraulic work, too. If you read 1,100 pages of The City of God, you spend a lot of time not talking about God. You know, making arguments with Porphyry and Varro, and making arguments that if you took, or arguments about a dozen pre-Socratics. What's the use of the arguments about a dozen pre-Socratics? They've been dead a long time, right? Well, arguments with a dozen pre-Socratics are really important if you know where you're going. If you're telling the story about the pre-Socratics in such a way as you show that there is an inherent logic that they're pursuing which is developing towards the notion of an intelligent design agent, right? Well, guess what? You're making explicit how that is fit to receive faith in the one true God. And you don't need to immediately make the move to say, believe. Saying that, Augustine never fails to do that when it's time. He never fails to ask. He never fails to close the deal. Sorry, I was talking to my business school, right? He never fails to bring the claim full frontal when it's time. When the interlocutor has at least conceded enough points to say, what I believe does not contradict what you believe. What a principle of non-contradiction is quite helpful. If you can just argue of the plausibility of the principle of non-contradiction, you can actually go somewhere. Belief in truth.
Right.
There's a truth to be found.
So is natural virtue, is that some way of understanding this concept of fitness? Is that in line with the concept of fitness?
Well, just arguing, I mean, just the very, in our context, in Augustine's context, he's selecting those thinkers who actually believe in something like virtue. Right? Who do you look to, non-theistically, who believe in something like virtue today? I mean, it's harder for us today. In a sense, we have greater challenges than Augustine. But I think, nevertheless, we have to make arguments which look at what is possible within the common objects and try to move them towards greater fitness, or at least to make arguments to say that your enemies, as Augustine says, can't say the Christian faith is irrational, or that you have good reasons to reject it. I think that's a very Thomistic thing too, is to remove obstacles from belief. You can't force anybody. You can't. Medievals have this word manuduction. You can lead people by the hand, but you can't. You just clear the way. It's just brush clearing. For God to work. That's a hydraulic endeavor, too. But I think a lot of times that's all we have. But I think Aquinas also has a beautiful image based on the Dominican habit, that if you clear the space in the right way, you see the contrast. You see the white against the black, in such a way as people can finally be receptive. There's no more obstacles to sight. If you remove those obstacles enough, you can see the contrast, and it's easier
it's easier to incline to cooperate with God's grace.
No further questions. We might just thank Dr. Picknell once more.